It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic. When I can, I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Every serial killer is a nice guy, until he's found out the shocking true account of a Southern charmer who left a trail of victims in his wake. Jerry Marcus fooled them all. He was a nice guy, always helped at home, did well in school, an athlete, and always employed. When things went wrong, he was the first to help clean up the mess. He was the last person anyone suspected of being a killer. After Marcus was caught and sentenced to life in prison in the late 70s, author Linda Lou Long spent years corresponding with him. The Tuskegee Strangler gives an inside look into the workings of a man who is not your typical serial killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Tuskegee Strangler, the nicest serial killer they ever met, with my special guest, author and researcher, Linda Lou Long. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Linda Lou Long.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. Let's start off with how you came to be the author of this story.
Where should I start? It just all started as a college class, and I just had to write about a serial killer, and I just happened to be on the phone to some friends in the state where Jerry Marcus was finally arrested, Mississippi, and they told me about a serial killer there, and I looked up the arresting officer, and that's how it all started.
Let's go back. You say these murders began in Tuskegee, Alabama, where this Tuskegee University is located. And Jerry Marcus, his father was Eddie Marcus, and his mother was Ruth. And his aunt lived next door, his paternal aunt lived next door. Tell us about Jerry Marcus, his family life, what that looked like, and how he grew up.
Well, I would say that they had a typical family, as it were, down south here. The street was dead end, and all the neighbors, everyone knew each other, and the aunt was next door. So it was a pretty comfortable setting. The father worked, and so did the mother. The father had a drinking problem, but it was just, that was partially, I guess, what started the onslaught of everything for Jerry Marcus, because he grew up seeing his mother getting abused by his father due to the alcohol, and he just went his own way with it.
You say that he was also abused by his father, and not only did he witness this and along with his siblings, but he also, you say, his behavior changed around 8 or 10 years old. He felt the badness. With this badness, you say that he first tortured animals, and we're talking very specific. So what was that torture of animals like? What did he have to say?
Well, it was kind of a rural area, so it wasn't like you were in the city, because Tuskegee is a small town, even now. And so there were lots of stray animals around, and Jerry had an affinity for pestering and torturing cats. He liked cats. He liked to torture them. And one in particular, which was mentioned in the press and mentioned in other accounts is that he would, there was one particular female and she was hanging around all the time. And so he dipped her, he got a hold of her and dipped her tail in, I think it was gasoline, and set it on fire so she would, you know, chase her tail until she died practically. So he was like that. And he liked to watch when things like this would happen, even though whether he set it up or watched it happen, you know, in the wild, he still liked to watch and liked to see the animal tormented.
What did he progress to when he saw the, when he felt the excitement of fire and its effect on these animals?
Well, early on, he was still really young and he was still pre-adolescent. And so he really didn't get a grasp of what these behaviors could lead to or what he was really experiencing or any of that. He was just experiencing a lot of different emotions and he was usually by himself. He didn't seem to have, he shied away from playmates, their kids, other than he would torment them at church and stuff. But he stayed away from the other kids and he was pretty much a solitary anyway. But he was always at with the animals and all and catching them in the timber. And because the whole house was, it was a real timber, large pine trees, real wooded area which they lived in. And so there was a lot of wild animals around that he had access to and would do things to.
You write about that his fascination, again, with fire led to, again, this interest in fire. And what did that lead to in terms of his behavior? What happened at the family home?
Well, the family home caught on fire. Now, there wasn't a police report or anything like that about it to read. And I just interviewed both his mother and his grandmother, and we all talked about it. But they never really, the grandmother and the mother never suspected Jerry of having anything to do with setting that fire. No one knew how it started, but they really didn't suspect him. Whereas it was probably one of Jerry's first efforts reaching out, you know, and seeing just how much he could get away with. And I think it simply got out of control. You know, he didn't really relate specifically what it was that triggered him. And I never could get that out of him. But he just really felt an affinity to fire and the smell of burning things and all. And like when he watched this house, his family house burn, he was sitting back in the timber and he was just really getting off on it and watching the sparks and everything in the grass. And he was really getting off on it, but there isn't, he didn't really relate. We didn't, okay, I will say that we didn't discuss it any further than the fact that he had said that he was involved with it. And I suspect it was a couch that was caught on fire and he thought it was more of a controllable thing, but it was not. So it caught the rest of the house on fire.
Now, a person that plays into this story of great importance is Gwen. And at 14 in grade school, Marcus and Gwen meet. Tell us what happens at the same time in terms of what's going on in his family between his parents.
Well, I will say that I only know about Gwen as far as Jerry was able to tell me. I have not personally met nor interviewed her because that was her request. She didn't want any part of it. And I respect that. So I wasn't going to do that. But according to Jerry, you know, they just met, had a lot in common, and she really impressed him because she was really smart. And he liked that. You know, he liked having a female that he could relate to, he said. So I'm not sure what that meant. But, you know, that's his major interest in her. And he never was any threat to Gwen as far as her safety or her well-being or anything either. It was like their relationship was completely separate from his other personality, which it truly was. I mean, she had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm sure she did.
You write that the parents were experiencing, well, the mother was experiencing violence at the hands of the father.
Right.
It was progressively getting worse. And that Marcus was certainly resorted to peeping in the neighborhood. He thought that everybody knew what was going on in his family anyway. And that was his justification, you write, for him to go and peep at young women in their underwear. After that, his schoolwork wasn't affected by his behavior, but at some point he excels in sports. And then tell us about the relationship as it develops with Gwen and they get married.
Well, there was a gap in there because Gwen had another relationship before Jerry and even believed that she was in New Orleans for a while. But I'm not sure of that, so I can't say. But they were having a relationship and seeing each other and stuff before they actually went to the courthouse and signed the papers and got formally married.
Right.
You know, they had a relationship. I guess they got back together, shall we say. You know, between being young and in love and in grade school and junior high and high school and stuff. And then the breakup between the two of them, you know, this, when she went her own way. And then they got back together. That was difference in there. She hadn't even been around, you know, when Jerry had been starting working there at the university and all. She hadn't even been around, really. But they got back together. And it was odd that there was such a stable relationship. And he still said that he respected her and he had no intention of ever doing any harm to her or her family, which he adopted as his.
It's interesting, you're right, before this as well, that when it was time to go to school, there wasn't any money. But when he asked his father anyway, he said, I wouldn't give you a red cent because you abandoned me and the family.
Right.
When the family had problems and the mother moved to New Orleans and left the family. So the father saw it as an abandonment of him and the family and said, I wouldn't give you a red cent for education. Marcus, Jerry went to his aunt. And his aunt provided the tuition for him to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And in college, he did well enough. Like you say, he was always, as you write, he was always concerned with being employed. And and by all reports, he was a good worker.
Mm-hmm.
So he was working at a hospital, the John D. Andrews Community Hospital.
Right. That was a Tuskegee hospital.
Right.
On the campus grounds.
Now, being on the campus grounds and being this person with this developing anger and hatred and obviously justification for everything he did do and had gotten away from the law and scraped by with various decisions in the courts. So he was definitely confident that he could fool law enforcement. What did this lead to on the campus of the Tuskegee University?
Well, you know, Jerry never had anything but a parking ticket on his record, nothing. And he was real good about skirting the law, you know, or just being on the edge of possibly being involved. And he was always seen to be around, you know, the detective in that area, Al Kendall out of Tuskegee. He never could quite pin Jerry because Jerry'd always just be on the fringe of things, always be there, always be looking, but not close enough to really pin him to anything for other issues in the future or even in the past when he was younger, because he had known him when he was really young. But I really can't say. Jerry's just, it was just an odd relationship because it was him and Gwen, they were so natural, so normal. He's back to Gwen and said, well, we should do this and we should get married now. And that's what they did. And it went on from there, but it just seemed like once that happened, it just started going downhill, the relationship.
Tell us about the incidents with the two student nurses, what they have to say, what he has to say, and the ramifications from that.
Well, they really didn't have anything to say since they were both dead, but it's so they couldn't have ever. It was just like those two girls and what happened to them dropped out of time. You know, it was almost impossible to find out and to trace this pattern all the way back to this, starting with these two girls. And the one, the very first one, he was working on campus then in maintenance. And that's how he saw her and began to know who she was and follow her, follow in the sense of footsteps, not by electronic means, because there weren't computers like that back then. But he was interested in her and he followed her. And that happened in 1971. And that was when her body, not even her body was never recovered, you see. And so she was just reported missing and she just dropped out of society. And then the next girl was less than a year later. And of course, they found Margaret's body. You know, he'd gone a step further with her. With the first girl, he hadn't. He supposedly had just strangled her by accident and dumped her body. But then no one ever found it. He never went. He went back. He couldn't find it. And so no one knows whatever happened to her. And I never could find anything other than the small mention in the student newspaper about her in particular. So her and Margaret Sturtevant, the very first two. Now, Margaret Sturtevant wasn't a nursing student. She was an engineering student.
Right.
But she was getting ready to graduate. She had a family already, was married, and had a child. And so it was odd that she was the one that he aggressed against and assaulted physically and left her body nude to be recovered. Now, that was strange, too. But then once those two acts were committed, within practically weeks after that, he ended up getting offered by someone who he'd gone to school with, who now was in Tennessee and Knoxville College. And he offered him a position there if he would come and play on their ball team. And then all of a sudden, nothing else mattered anymore. And he left Gwen and his family behind and his parents and that part of the family behind. And he went to Tennessee.
What I had mentioned about the nursing students was it just seemed to set up an MO where he would be on the campus. He said that he was working at the hospital and got some phenobarbital for these women. They told a different story. And then I say that when he hooks up with Gwen, he marries Gwen, then this is when he decides to go on these murderous urges that he can't to kill, that he responds to.
Right.
And then you say that, again, he leaves Gwen and is able, like a true psychopath, as you call him, to be able to just go and excel at school and go on this, well, to at least go to school on this scholarship and excel in sports.
Right.
As attested to this scholarship.
Right.
You say he moves to Tennessee. Now, what's unusual about this serial killer is that he's a very nice guy. No one suspects him. But there is something else about this serial killer that's unusual. Tell us.
Well, it was almost 8 years between what he did to the two students on the university in 71, early and late 71. And then his next act wasn't committed until October of 1983. So he went many years with a break before he planned to attack someone else. Because, see, these weren't strangers. The next girl that he goes after, he met her when he went and he applied for public aid and for food stamps.
Yes.
And she helped him get food stamps. And he set up a date with her and they went out two or three different times. And then I think it was the third date. He just decided he was done with her and he killed her too.
And so you're talking about Francine Davis.
Yes.
Yes.
Francine.
So police have no idea. Again, he's never a suspect, except later we'll talk about Al Kendall and his suspicions.
Right.
Let's talk about what happens with the case of Francine Davis. How do police respond and what do they find, if anything?
Francine Davis was another weird sort of thing because he completely switched over his whatever MO he was trying to establish with those other girls.
Right.
And he really wasn't. You know, both of those were incidents building up to what else was going to happen in the future. They really weren't planned and all of that. But with this girl, he spent quite a bit of time in her apartment. They had gone to play tennis and she had gone in to shower and came out of the shower and he assaulted her and he strangled her. But he didn't just assault and strangle her. He was really worried about the other girls. In the back of his mind, he never knew if someone was going to pop their head up and say, "Hi, I'm so-and-so and so-and-so, and you tried to kill me all those years ago." He was very afraid of that, that someone was going to come back and get him someday. So he wanted to make sure that Francine was dead. So he submerged Francine in the bathtub and held her underwater until the air bubbles quit coming up. And he describes that. And then he took her out of the tub and dried her off and redressed her in a fresh set of, well, pajamas, whatever she had.
Right.
And set her up in the bed and propped her up and had a note beside her hand with a pencil saying, "I hate you, Arthur," her husband's name, who she was separated from. And he really set her up. He cleaned them. entire apartment. He cleaned everything up. The place looked like it was a hotel practically. And that was what the officers who came on the scene, and they thought she had had an attack related to a respiratory disorder she had.
Right.
And that she had simply suffocated with the medication or whatever, because he had laid out her medicine and all, and that's what they thought happened. They had no idea until he confessed and they were contacted that he was the one who had killed her and that she was a murder suspect, not an incidental death, because the case had already been closed.
Yeah, he was trying to frame the boyfriend. He saw a photo and then he forged a note that said, "I hate you, Arthur."
Right.
And sort of this note that he wanted police to find. And in fact, they did.
Right. That's so they blame him.
Yeah. Now,
he's a very nice person. I met him and he gave me a pretty picture of Francine.
Right. Now, at the same time, Marcus has a dilemma, because he has been using his girlfriend, Lynn's car. He's supposed to pick her up. Meanwhile, he's doing this murdering. So what's the idea that he hatches in his mind?
He gave her some excuse that he didn't pick her up from work. And he gave her some excuse that when he finally got home, I believe she reported him to the police as missing because he had her car. And he just told her that he had been robbed and assaulted. He said sexually assaulted at first, and then he decided he'd just change it to assaulted because he wanted to leave the sex part out. And it was funny the way he described it. And that was the excuse that he got. And he went to the police station there and filed a report and all this stuff about something that never happened when he slept in her car in a parking lot across the street. So, it was interesting in that sense that he got out of picking her up, and that was the excuse he provided, was that he had been assaulted and robbed when he didn't have any money in the first place, and she said so.
Right. You write that he knew and he had experienced Al Kendall for years, since the 70s, so he wanted to call somewhere else where he knew Al Kendall wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to him, Al Kendall speaks to the person that speaks to Marcus.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit later. A short while later.
Yeah.
Anyway, he is questioned. Police think this story sounds cockeyed anyway.
Yeah.
So his initial questioning began May 14th, 1986. And you say he told several different stories, raising one red flag after another.
Right.
But there is another person that's missing. And Mr. Class, no, May 8th, 1986, Yvette Chambers. So
right.
Tell us about this questioning and what happens.
He met Yvette at a local bar and they saw each other about three different times. And he gives two or three different ideas of what he did and who was involved and the cars they were driving and what they were wearing. And most of it was never able to prove. It all was, different stories. He told the police there in Tennessee one story, and then he told everyone he got home, he told another story and another story after that, and just changing little bits like what she wore and how she wore it and where he saw them arguing on the bridge and all kinds of dumb excuses. Really didn't have anything to do with anything, but he started tangling things up then. I guess he had tried to, he didn't have to keep anything straight with the first two individuals. They were just gone. But when he started adding more with Francine and then with Yvette, he started getting confused and mixing up his own stories, not meaning to, but he wasn't prepared. He didn't feel like he was going to be questioned. He thought that he was going to be special and ignored like he'd been ignored in the past back in Tuskegee, because everyone had no idea that he would ever do anything like that. So he was never questioned or suspected, but it was different. Once he came back and he started killing again, because he came back and started working on campus again, except this time for a construction crew, but he still had access to the campus. And that's where he found Yvette Chambers the first time.
Tell us about this Lenora Wright, which was murdered 18 days after Yvette Chambers.
Right.
And this is a wild story, again, so bizarre. Marcus is grocery shopping with his aunt, Mrs. Owens.
Right.
What does Mrs. Owens do? She knows Lenora. What happens?
She didn't ever dream anything like this was going to happen when she introduced them.
Sure.
And she just introduced them at the grocery store, and she just knew her from seeing her going in and out of church. She wasn't intimate with her or knew her mother or grandmother or any of that stuff. But, you know, when she introduced them and they hit it right off, she was all for it because she thought she was a nice girl and her, you know, nephew was a wonderful kid and he deserved a break and meeting someone nice who went to her church and da 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 da. But it wasn't that way at all. You know, it ended up being, well, she ended up dead. And he didn't even hardly pause. She was a pickup date a couple of times. He picked her up at home and took her out and brought her back. And then this incident happened and she fell and she hurt herself supposedly. And the stories he gave, because he gave several, you know, more than one story about her too.
Now you write though that she talks, it's 6 days before her disappearance is brought to the attention of Tuskegee Police Department. And then they search her house and find her body.
Right. No one ever.
But again, there's an autopsy. What's the cause of death determination?
Strangulation was his favorite. He liked to strangle.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. When they say mental health is a journey, they mean it. That's why it's important to prioritize your mental health and wellness every day. When you work on yourself, it brings positive changes in all areas of your life. The long-term effects of therapy can give you the tools to deal with challenges as they arise, strengthen your relationships, and give you a more positive outlook on life. There's no better time to invest in yourself than right now. Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform that has thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. Talkspace is a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. Instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, and they'll engage with you daily, 5 days a week. Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code TRUEMURDER to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's TRUEMURDER and Talkspace.com. Now, Linda, we talked about the noose tightening around Jerry Marcus, and beginning in June 18th, 1897, you say that Marcus gave his first confession to Captain David Lindley when finally arrested for his last murder in Starkville. Now, that last murder is a woman named Ellerby. So let's talk about Wadeen Braun Ellerby and where she was buried, interestingly.
Well, Wadeen was, her body was recovered in April of 1987, but she was killed by Jerry Marcus, an estimated on or before September 16th, 1986. So she was in the ground for several months, but they were after, she came home to his house to use his telephone to supposedly call and find a stronger form of drug, find cocaine, I believe it was.
Sure.
And they used the phone and she supposedly faked it and held the receiver down and all this stuff. And he knew she had lied. He heard the tone and he knew she had lied, but he went along with it, you know, and played her. Okay, well, let's go ahead and go and get in the car and go drive back to the bar or whatever and check so-and-so and check it there. So they're leaving. And the house, a lot of these brick houses, concrete block houses in the South will have the staircases to the second story on the outside of the house.
Okay.
Which is the way it was with this house. And he made sure she lost her footing going down, and she fell all the way to the bottom from the second story to the first. Now, I was there and I took pictures and I could see how someone, you know, could kill themselves falling, but we're not really sure if she was dead when he drug her into the timber or not, because he drug her into the timber to sexually assault her. And he never really knew if she was dead or alive or checked anything like that. But once he was finished with her, he realized she hadn't woken up, you know, and she was probably dead. But again, he's not sure. And he decides to bury her back there in the timber behind the house. You know, but the ground in the south is really clay and really hard and hard. And he was back there with sticks trying to dig out a spot to put her in. And he used whatever tools they had at the house, and he made a depression deep enough to lay her body in. But he went back to the house and got the red plastic tablecloth out of the lower level that had been on a table down there. And he wrapped her body in that and put her in a grave of sorts, because it's still, like I said, it's impossible to dig holes in this, you know, without major tools. The ground's really hard. And he just started covering her with debris and just kept covering her and visiting the body and recovering it and adding more stuff to break down the body, because he knew by that time she was dead. She may not have been dead when he first put her under and started burying her and left her there. She may have well bled to death. Oh, we just don't know.
Now, write again about another murder, April 14th. There's a missing persons report for a Dorothy Dot Davis. Tell us about Dorothy and her demise.
Well, Dorothy, she went by Dot. She was the last one. And again, she was someone he just met while he was using his girlfriend's car and living at his girlfriend's house. He met Dot out and started meeting Dot and going places with Dot. And why is a good question, because it happened, you know, Ellerby was gone. And no one knew she was just missing. No one knew she was buried in Jerry Marcus' backyard. And he was never,
right.
He was never hooked to her. The girlfriend, her girlfriends and such said that she was going on a date with somebody. But she didn't really say that it was Jerry Marcus or he was the one she was meeting.
Right.
And then when Dot died, when he murdered Dot, they hadn't been seeing each other any more than 2.5 to 3 weeks, and he killed her too. So he had just reached the phase where he couldn't stop killing them, and he wasn't sure why he was wanting to do it, but he just couldn't stop.
Right.
You know, in the end, you know, I guess they all reach a peak, but it's just all, you know, he went so many years, 7.5, 8 years with nothing. And then all of a sudden he blows and he doesn't really know why. He doesn't know what happened other than the fact that he lost his job. That's the only correlating factor there is. He lost his job. And that's why he killed Francine Davis or met Francine Davis to kill her. So it's interesting. Dot was an innocent party. She just met him, went out with him a couple of times, and he killed her. You know, they were all innocent girls, women. They weren't prostitutes or anything like that. They weren't looking for trouble. They were a waitress, a state employee, students. There were no reason. They weren't asking to be killed or asking to become victims of a serial killer.
Let's talk about his capture and then the confession and how it was gained.
Okay. Well, like I said, he was questioned repeatedly over the other girls, and they just couldn't hook him. There were no witnesses, no one actually saying, well, hey, I saw it. I saw them. So there was no real witnesses to tie him to any of those, except for the Dot Davis one. And that's the one where he finally broke down himself. It wasn't that they had more evidence or a way to tie him or other witnesses, because that's what there wasn't, was any witnesses. But he managed to lose it himself. He had reached his peak and he lost it. And he told about, he gave up on the one. He told several different stories about Dot Davis. And then he finally gave up on her. He said, okay, I did kill her. She's dead. And That's when he started telling about all the rest. He said, well, then I guess I'll have to tell you about the rest of them, too. And these guys had no idea. David Lindley, they had no idea. He had just finished a class at the FBI headquarters on serial homicide and serial killers before he ever met Marcus. So I guess he was fresh with current data to use to follow a serial killer. But no one knew. No one knew until the very last minute when he confessed that he had killed all those girls all in the past. No one knew.
You write about the correspondence that you have with Jerry Marcus eventually and the things he told you after you'd already read and been privy to all the confessions officially and all the information that he imparted at those confessions. Let's talk about his justification that he talks about and that he says to these Al Kendall and David Lindley and others in his confession. What is his justification? Why does he do this? What seems to be the pattern in terms of whose fault and why this occurs?
You know, I can go over it a million different times and you can't pin it down to one thing or even two or any instigating factors. It could be other than employment and losing a job or gaining a job. But that's never been proven before as being a factor in someone who's a serial killer, that they are a repeat offender for work is kind of what he is. There isn't any specific thing. He just loses control and he doesn't try to stop. You know, with the first two girls, I think he tried to stop during those several years. He tried to get control of himself, that he realized that what he had done wasn't what he should be doing. And he tried to get control, but then he lost it again. And once it was gone the second time, he just started a downhill roll as far as one right after another, because he didn't, you know, once he stepped over the line the third time, the real time, that was when he just started one right after another. And he never, I asked him repeatedly, why? Why do you do it? Why do you feel the need? And he says, I'm just that way. I just feel like I should kill. That's all. And there's no other rationale for it. I mean, I'm hoping to link him what was written about in this book.
Right. You write that what I was getting to was that in each one of these instances, there's something that compels him in terms of his anger and he just can't turn back. But they are very much like when he was young, you write, that there were small, relatively insignificant events which created this murderous anger. A woman stole $60 that he was driving her around. And then when he went to look for his $60, he says she admitted that she stole the $60 but would pay him back. They have sex. They say they make love, describes as making love, and then he has to kill her. The other woman lied to him. The other woman possibly cheated on him. So for fairly insignificant reasons, he was willing to kill.
And things he created himself.
Yeah, certainly.
You know, I mean, we don't know if that's even true, but the way he describes it, I mean, it's insignificant. It doesn't make any sense why someone would kill someone else for such a trivial reason.
And as you write, it's very unusual for a serial killer to prey on people that he's intimate with, dated, played tennis with, recommended by his aunt, knows the family, and yet.
And he went back to his comfort zone. You know, he left his comfort zone of Tuskegee and where he'd been before and where he had felt all those initial emotions, and they went to Tennessee, but then he came back to Tuskegee. So he came back to his comfort zone after having stepped out and killed somewhere else. Then he came back. So it's interesting returning to the scene of the crime.
You interestingly write, again, not to look for excuses, but more so for reasons psychologically connecting the behavior at these crimes to the behavior that he witnessed from his father beating his mother, in particular, this brown belt. Tell us the significance of the brown belt, leather belt.
Well, his dad always wore it. It's a brown leather belt. And I have seen it, but I wasn't allowed to take it. It's in the hands of the sheriff of that county, or at least it was. He wouldn't let me have it in evidence. But anyway, when he was a kid, they would listen for the snap of that belt being pulled out. You know, when his father would pull it out of his belt loops, the snap that belt would make those children jump. You know, that they knew that that's what that meant, that they were going to get whipped or mom was going to get whipped, or mom had done something. It was always mom had done something, you know. So I think it was the sound of it was just embedded in his brain from youth, and the pain that would be related to him if he didn't have in his, if he didn't have the belt in his hand and could control it that way, that he would get struck himself, or he would be injured, or his mother would be injured. But if he could just wear the same belt and use the same belt in a different way, then he could keep from being injured by it again.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When I mentioned the belt, though, it's you have a very vivid graphic scene where he goes to strangle this woman. Unbeknownst to her, he reaches in the back seat for a leather belt and wraps it around her neck. This is one of his techniques, isn't it?
Correct. He came at her from behind. Like I said, I believe they were drinking in the car or had been, and she was, you know, relaxed. She wasn't thinking she was in the car with a killer. And he was in tennis shorts, so it had no belt loops. So he had the belt laying in the floorboard behind her. And he reached behind her, and she wasn't sure what he was doing back there. And he's just moving some stuff around to loop it and then slip it back over her neck and strangle her from behind, basically. I mean, when she turned towards him, he dropped it over her and he held it in his right hand. And he supposedly put his other hand on her shoulder and strangled her like that. Right. He turned her in the seat towards him. But these are just his descriptions.
We didn't talk about the trial, but you briefly mentioned the trial, May 30th, 1989, for the murders in Alabama. And he was tested psychiatric testing. And there's some, we'll talk about what those, what that diagnosis was. But he was sentenced in Alabama to a life sentence, yet he is detained. He's on a detainer for the other two states, Mississippi and Tennessee. Isn't that correct?
Well, I'm not sure about the Tennessee ruling because it had already been, you know, they would have to bring him out of prison to send, you know, put him in court again. I mean, that would have to be heard.
Sure.
And it's a different state. So the laws, you know, the rulings could be different in statute and time. But the one in Mississippi is first because that's where he was captured.
Right.
And that is a life sentence because I believe at the time they were having some sort of a legal thing going on with the death penalty.
Right.
So the death penalty was suspended at that time or frozen or whatever word they choose to use. So he got life imprisonment. But the way the judge wrote it, he said, I'll make sure that you never get out again into society. But after when he went to jail for that, then the other proceedings in Tuskegee and all of that, they weren't really heard as cases because there were no witnesses. There were no victims. There was only him. So they weren't really heard. He was just charged in the Mississippi case. Now, this has just been recent. I mean, he's filed charges against the Mississippi correctional system a couple of different times for mishandlement, but that's been since he's been in. But the only one he was seriously tried for and convicted of was the Mississippi case, and that'd be Dorothy Davis.
Let's talk about your visit to the Parchman Penitentiary in Mississippi to visit Jerry Marcus. And how did this come about? Whose suggestion was this? Let's talk about Dr. Ager and how he convinced you to do this and why.
Well, like I said, I met Steve Ager when he was the instructor in the class. And I had never really, I'd studied a little bit about serial killers, but it wasn't on the top of my list. But I really developed an interest in it. And he helped me go through the paperwork and helped me determine what was right and wasn't, or what could be used and what not. Because, see, initially I wrote the chapter for Jerry Marcus in his 2000 textbook. And that was the first time it had ever been in print. But it's written in a format that Dr. Edgar followed for each of the serial killers that were chaptered in that book.
So you went to the prison to visit him. What was that experience like? What did you expect and what did you experience?
I didn't know. Steve said, Dr. Egger, he said, well, you should go down and visit him. And I said, how do you do that? I didn't know. So I got a hold of the public information officer who sent me the proper forms to fill out, and I had to fill out this, and I had to fill out that, and all these forms. And they had to ask him because he'd never had any visitors.
Right.
He had to consent to see me. Now, I don't know anything about that prison, Parchman Penitentiary, but it supposedly is one of the strictest in the state, you know, of Mississippi.
Sure.
But he gave me permission. So I went down there and I can't describe it. It was just really strange because I was in business clothes, khakis and a roll up sleeve shirt and all this stuff. But it was like families, and you got on a bus. You went through the first level of security and they had these little buildings attached to each other. And you went through the first level and then practically a body search. And then you get in the bus to go. And the only thing that I had was a pad of paper and a pen. They said, can't take either one. So I had to leave. I couldn't take anything. So you go through at least five different of those little cabins for body checks and searches and through machines and this and that and the other. But the others were like, the other people visiting were like families with little kids and everything but the family dog and groups and big brown bags and of stuff, which I didn't relate to at the time. And then we finally get through all those levels of security. Then it all opens up into the first real building down there in the Delta, a big concrete building like a gymnasium. And that's what it was. And it had the pull down hoops and it had the pull out wooden seats, the old fashioned wooden seats. And they were pulled out and there were tables and chairs scattered everywhere. And it was just like a big picnic. And they just turned everybody loose in the room with each other. So, you know, I've been expecting back in Illinois, I've been expecting a little more, like maybe sheet of glass and a phone, but no, yeah. They turn everybody loose together and everybody has a fine old time. And so, you know, I actually met him and sat beside him and talked to him.
What was that like? You had corresponded with him for over a year, years.
Years and years. Well, he said, you don't look like I thought you would. And I said, well, I can't say that because I saw your pictures already. And we laughed, you know, because that was my whole goal, to get him know that he can relax and talk to me and talk, you know. And so I just made a couple of jokes. He was so neat, you know. He has a real strong lean towards narcissism. He always has, even when he was a kid. And when I first met him, his uniform, it was spotless. There wasn't a thing wrong with his uniform. It was practically creased in the knees. His shoes were clean. His socks were clean. His hand looked like he'd been to a manicurist and everything. He looked really neat and clean. And I was just kind of looking at him sideways. And he said, well, what are you looking for? What do you keep looking at me like that for? And I said, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of disappointed. I expected blood dripping from your fingers or from your mouth or something. And he just thought that was the funniest thing. And he just started laughing. He thought that was really funny. And I said, there, that's what I want you to do. I want you to relax. I want you to laugh. And I want you just to talk to me. And we just talked about stuff. You know, about, you know, I couldn't really say, well, can we talk about so-and-so or can we talk about so-and-so? Because we'd already done all that. He had already written everything out, every page and rewritten and written. So it really wasn't like that. But we just basically talked. And I said, so what do you expect to do with all this? I mean, with here, I said, are you here like forever? And he said, oh, no, I'll be going on a picnic with my kids soon, with my grandkids, and we're going to meet out there and we're going to see that table over there. Da, 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 da. You know, just dreamland. He has no concept that he's there forever. You know,
you talk about interviews with his mother and his aunt.
Yes.
You say that everything that was going to be said, that was said, that information about the murders expanded from those confessions he gave to you in that correspondence, so that the interview you had was anticlimactic in that regard. But mm-hmm. what about the interviews with the mother and the aunt? What was that like?
Well, I wanted to do it right. I wanted to be respectful to these ladies for giving me the time to talk to me, because they, like everyone else, was totally shocked and really were kind of out of touch with it. I really didn't believe he'd done it.
Right.
Mm. So they were willing to talk to me. I took pictures with them. As a matter of fact, I took my mother with me on the trip down there, because she's from Mississippi, and I just figured that, well, maybe they'd feel a little calmer. You know, we could all just, all the old ladies having a discussion. So we sat down in there in the aunt's front room, and we talked, you know, for a couple of hours. I brought them both a bouquet of flowers, and I brought them some sort of a coffee cake that I got down at the bakery and all this stuff, because I wanted to be respectful to these women. But they, in turn, answered my questions that I had about Jerry. You know, when did he start? And they related to me about the cats with the tail on fire and how he used to torture animals and how they find animals that were dead, and that they knew that Jerry had been busy again and such as that. But they said they never dreamed that that would lead to what it did lead to, and that would be that he would start killing human beings. I don't think that really, they just thought that that was a phase, you know, in the darkened room and the covered windows and the anger spurts that he used to have. They just thought that he would grow out of it, that it was just a phase. They never dreamed he would grow more so into it than he ever had.
Yeah, that must have been a fascinating conversation, but also the resignment of those two people, like you say, to be inextricably involved in some of this, of his murderous behavior. The aunt introducing the one woman and burying a victim in the backyard of the home, of a family home.
Right, right. Well, they were equally shocked about all of that, and they were just still so sure that he really couldn't have done that. You know, I mean, they just kept trying to rationale that somehow it just still had to be a mistake, that he couldn't have really done that. That someday they're going to find out that Jerry was innocent. He isn't and wasn't, you know, but they were just, because he had always been the perfect son and always been the perfect nephew and always been there for to help everyone, and including the neighbors. And so it was just these ladies tried to give me as much information. They answered every question that I had. And especially with Francine, I believe, you know, she said, I had no idea. You know, she said, I just knew her from church. I thought that they would be a nice pair and they were going to go out and eat out. And she thought, I thought that was a good thing. But then it wasn't. But then again, that was many years later. So she had no idea that what she had, you know, the introduction had ended up in, this is what happened.
And his aunt thought he was such a fine nephew. You write at the very end with your visit with Jerry Marcus that, again, that he was charming, he exhibited all those things you knew you would find, but you were seeing him in person for the first time. And mm-hmm. and you saw his well-manicured hands, and he was dressed well, and all appearances. But you realized in the circumstances of that visiting room that he certainly could have ended your life quite easily with those bare hands that he used to strangle other women to death.
Well, now you got to remember, this was in a gymnasium and we were sitting on wooden pullout seats. So it was like so casual. I mean, it was just like there were no guards anywhere around except the far doors, you know, so he could have really done anything. And that's why I told him, I guess, like, you know, I said, well, I guess you can do about anything you want. And now, and he said, yeah, I could kill you.
Wow.
He said, you're the only other one I know now. He said, I could kill you. He said, but then he said, I wouldn't get to talk to you anymore. Admitted that he liked to talk to me. But like I said, we haven't spoken since. There was a law enforcement in Tennessee who sought to talk to him directly without saying anything to me, and he considered that offensive, and he has not spoken to me since that time or answered any letters. Or because for a while I sent him, you know, occasionally I'd deposit money in his account, I'd send him money for personal stuff and all, but he never spoke to me again after that. So that also tells me that there's probably something else going on in Tennessee to relate him to also, since it shut him right down and he didn't want to talk at all. So chances are there's something going on.
Absolutely.
Or had been something going on.
Did he know that you were writing this book?
Yes, he did. From day one. From day one. Because I started writing to him as Jane Doe. You know? And I told him, I said, it was 3 or 4 letters before I was finally willing to give him my name. And then I had a special P.O. box. And I had that P.O. box for all those years. And that was the sole reason for the P.O. box, was to write him and get lettered back from him.
It's very interesting. Your book, we just touched on them, but elaborate, detailed confessions of what he did, how he killed these people, the conversations he had beforehand, and most interestingly, his thoughts behind his behavior and his actions. I want to thank you very much, Linda Lou Long, for coming on and talking about Tuskegee Strangler, the nicest serial killer they ever met. This is a Wild Blue Press release, but when did this book, when was it released?
On August the 2nd, 2022.
Just a few weeks ago. Yes. Thank you so much, Linda Lou Long, the Tuskegee Strangler, the nicest serial killer they ever met. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview. And good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.